Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. This is episode 387 of the Divine Intervention Podcast. And in today's podcast, I'm going to be addressing high-yield adverse drug reactions to know for the USMLE Step 2 CK and Step 3 exams. High-yield adverse drug reactions. I try to cover all of the major ones in this podcast, but if I cannot, I'll just have a part 2 on this. And if you're taking the USMLE Step 2 CK or Step 3 or Complex Level 2 or 3 exams, I have some courses that are available. First, I have a very comprehensive 75-hour school. It's called the DISC School. It's going to be taking place in the first 2 weeks of the month of May. It's going to be from Monday to Friday, 7.5 hours each day. Very high-level course. We're going to be doing an expanded test-taking strategies course. We're going to be doing a lot of stuff with adaptive learning, where we use images and keywords and things to review a lot of material very rapidly. And then we'll have the actual traditional review. And I'm also going to spend a lot of time answering people's questions and things like that. I'm going to invest deeply in every single person that attends. There's limited space available. If you're interested, shoot me an email through the website and I'll be happy to give you some more information. And also, if you're taking, you know, Step 2 CK, Step 3, I have a smaller course. It's the 20-hour course. It's going to be taking place on the 21st and 28th of May. It's going to be 10 hours each of those days for a total of 20 hours. We're going to review a lot of concepts from PEDS, from internal medicine, surgery, OB-GYN, neuro, psych, biostats, ethics, communications, healthcare systems, multi-systems processes and disorders. And then I have the MBME test taking strategies class. Again, tons of people have taken this class. They've done extremely well on the exams as a result. It's going to be on the 20th of May from 5 to 7:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. So if you're interested in any of these courses, just shoot me an email and I'll be more than happy to give you some more information. The courses are all going to be held over Zoom, and especially with the 20-hour course and the test taking strategies course, I try to put it at times where I know that people will not be on rotations, that they'll be able to attend. So it's like two back-to-back Saturdays, and then the test taking strategies class is like a Friday evening, literally. So again, if you're interested, just shoot me an email. So let's just jump right into it. So what if they give you a question about a patient, they tell you that the patient has a history of Graves' disease and the patient was recently started on pharmacotherapy, and then you notice that, wow, this person for the last 2 days, they've been having fevers and chills and shortness of breath. Then what are you thinking about? They may not even have shortness of breath. They may just have fevers and chills. Then what are you going to be thinking about? Well, if you see that, I'd really hope you're saying, oh, Divine, this person probably has agranulocytosis, right, from PTU or methimazole. These are classic things they love to test. Let me just tell you this. This podcast, you're going to for sure see questions on this stuff on your exams. It'll be highly unlikely that you take an exam and you don't see anything tested from here, right? So that's agranulocytosis. So remember, this is something we find with PTU and we find with methimazole, the anti-thyroid medications. PTU and methimazole, they have this adverse effect of agranulocytosis. But remember, agranulocytosis is not just an adverse effect of PTU and methimazole. You can also find this with other drugs, right? Don't forget, like, they can give you a person on therapy for trigeminal neuralgia or on anti-seizure medication. And in those circumstances, right, I would imagine that you're thinking of carbamazepine. Carbamazepine can absolutely cause agranulocytosis. Or they can give you a question about a person that has resistant schizophrenia. And then you should be thinking about clozapine. Remember, clozapine also causes many other things like myocarditis, so it can cause heart failure. Remember, clozapine can also cause a person to have hypersalivation, right? Those people will just be leaking a lot of saliva. Just something you want to keep at the back of your mind for exams. And then agranulocytosis is also something you can find with chloramphenicol. Chloramphenicol is a big drug for causing agranulocytosis. Remember, we also try to avoid giving it to women that are pregnant if we can, or like very little kids, because remember, it can absolutely cause gray baby syndrome. Can cause like heart failure and all those things. Not a good look, obviously, in those circumstances. And then what if they give you a question about a patient? They tell you that this patient is a young guy. He was recently treated for some kind of tachyarrhythmia. And then over the last 2 weeks, he has been having like joint pain, and he has like this rash on his face that is worsened with sun exposure. Well, if you see that, I would really hope you're saying, oh, Divine, this is going to be drug-induced lupus. Drug-induced lupus, remember, is associated with antihistone antibodies, and it's something you're going to find in this person, I guess, with procainamide. You can also find it with hydralazine. You can find it with isoniazid, sulfonamides. You can find it with etanercept, right? So those are the classic drugs Phenytoin as well can also be associated with drug-induced lupus. Although, remember, let me just maybe back up a little bit. So this procainamide business, I said, right, obviously the tachyarrhythmia the person had was Wolf Parkinson White. So remember, WPW, we acutely treated with procainamide, but long-term, it's actually kind of high yield to know that you don't want to be putting people on procainamide forever. No, that's not smart or prudent. The thing you'd want to do for those people is you want to ablate that pathway. That's the primary treatment of choice, best long-term treatment for Wolf Parkinson White syndrome. Remember, obviously, that's going to have the delta wave. Although these days, our friends at the MBMEs are like, let's not do delta wave again. All these med students know this stuff. So they're going to replace it on your exam with short PR plus wide QRS. If you see that, boom, that's all you need. The person has a WPW, especially in a young person. For the most part, they're not going to give WPW to a 70-year-old person on an exam. Okay, now what if they give you a question about a patient? They tell you that this patient just received chemotherapy for testicular cancer. They had like a 3-month course of chemotherapy, but that now this person has been having shortness of breath, and they give you some pulmonary labs, and you notice that the lung capacities are, like the lung volumes are decreased, and the FEV1 to FVC ratio though is normal. If you see something like that, what do you want to think about? I really hope you're thinking about pulmonary fibrosis. Remember, pulmonary fibrosis can happen with a couple of drugs on exams, right? So with the chemotherapeutic agents, we're looking more along the lines of like busulfan, bleomycin, methotrexate. Those things can absolutely cause pulmonary fibrosis. But some other ones that we should think about with pulmonary fibrosis, actually, you want to think about drugs like amiodarone. So they can give you a question about a person that is on chronic therapy for an arrhythmia. Because there are some people that, believe it or not, take amiodarone on a chronic basis. Although as physicians, we try to not do that often anymore. But then also think of nitrofurantoin, right? The drug that's known as Macrobid. Many people take nitrofurantoin. This side effect is extremely rare, but people can absolutely get pulmonary fibrosis with nitrofurantoin. So that's something you want to keep at the back of your mind for exams. Now, what if they give you a question about a patient? You know, they tell you that this patient has a history of familial hypercholesterolemia, and then they tell you that, you know, he's on therapy for primary prevention of a myocardial infarction. He takes it every day. Or they can even make a question where a person has like low back pain and they're taking a particular kind of drug every day for their pain. And then they tell you that this person has now started having respiratory difficulty, and that the respiratory difficulty typically arises a few hours after the person has taken the medication. What do you want to think about? I would encourage you to think about asthma, right? Remember, aspirin, and not just aspirin, but NSAIDs in general, they can trigger asthma in certain individuals. So what's the pathophysiology there? Well, you don't really need to memorize much of anything here, but if you remember the synthesis pathway involving arachidonic acid, you know, first off, you convert membrane phospholipids to arachidonic acid, and then arachidonic acid can go one of two ways. It can go through the cyclooxygenase pathway to make prostaglandins, or it can go down the lipooxygenase pathway to make leukotrienes. So the thing is, if you give an NSAID or aspirin and that inhibits cyclooxygenase, then the only pathway available for arachidonic acid is the leukotriene pathway. So you make a lot of leukotrienes, like leukotriene B4, for example. Remember, leukotriene B4 is a very powerful chemotactic factor for neutrophils. And, you know, ultimately it can cause things like increased vascular permeability and all those things. So it can certainly trigger a person's asthma symptoms. So remember that there's this thing called aspirin-induced asthma, although these days they call it aspirin-exacerbated respiratory disease. That's the pathophysiology. So you can get that with aspirin, and you can absolutely get that with NSAIDs. And then what if they give you a question about a patient? They tell you that this patient is on, was an immigrant and presented a few months ago with fevers, night sweats, weight loss, and the person was placed on combination pharmacotherapy. And then now, they tell you that over the last 3 days, he has been having yellowing of his skin, and he's been having right upper quadrant pain. You want to think about hepatitis, right? You want to think about hepatitis. Now remember, there are certain drugs that can torch the liver. Don't forget, the TB drugs, these things love to go after the liver, right? Famping is hepatotoxic. Isoniazid is hepatotoxic. In fact, there's this mnemonic I use, because isoniazid, some people call it INH. I remember it as I for isoniazid is neurotoxic, so it can cause seizures and all those problems. That's the N. But it's also hepatotoxic. It can cause liver failure. That's the H, right? So don't forget hepatotoxicity with the TB drugs, rifampin and isoniazid. But also don't forget with acetaminophen, right? Acetaminophen is probably the most, it's not probably, it is the most common drug cause of liver failure. You want to think of that with acetaminophen, but also do not forget your statins. Your statins can also be hepatotoxic. Your statins can also be hepatotoxic. And then don't forget amiodarone. Remember amiodarone, you're going to be checking a person's PFTs, LFTs, and TFTs. Amiodarone is also a hepatotoxic medication because it's heavily metabolized by the liver. And then what if they give you a question about a patient? They tell you that she's a 35-year-old female. And for the last 2 months, she has been having this non-specific right upper quadrant pain. But they tell you that her EST and ALT are just mildly elevated. And they tell you that she's on, medications for the prevention of pregnancy. If you see that, what are you thinking about? I would really hope you're thinking about hepatic adenomas, right? And OCPs. Oral contraceptive pills. Remember, especially the ones that contain estrogen, they're not good in people that have history of hepatic adenomas, because those things grow in response to estrogen. That's very high yield to know. Those things grow in response to estrogen. And remember, hepatic adenomas, many times you don't touch those things. They will try to trick you on the exam into like intervening. No, you don't intervene for hepatic adenomas. Those do not touch lesions, right? So remember, there are certain liver lesions that you don't touch. Hepatic adenomas, you don't touch. Focal nodular hyperplasia, you don't touch. Hepatic hemangiomas, you don't touch. Just leave well enough alone. You don't have to get too creative. You only intervene for those lesions if the person is like very symptomatic. But most times you don't have to touch those things. And also, they can decide not to give you an OCP question, and they can just give you a question about a person that has like testicular atrophy and looks very muscular. Anabolic steroids. Anabolic steroids can absolutely cause hepatic adenomas to grow as well. So that's just something you want to keep at the back of your mind for exams. And then, what if they give you a question about a child? You know, they tell you that this child had meningitis, was placed like a neonate, was placed on an antibiotic, and then now this child has developed jaundice, right? And then they give you some labs, and you notice that the total bilirubin is 4, and the indirect bilirubin is 0.9. Well, obviously, that tells you that, okay, this person's direct bilirubin is 3.1. So the thing is, what drug did this person child get? This child obviously got like ceftriaxone. Remember, ceftriaxone has the ability to cause intrahepatic cholestasis. So that can present with an obstructive pattern of liver disease. So that's just something you want to keep in mind. There are just certain drugs that slow down the movement of bile. So that can cause almost like an obstructive picture of liver disease. So that's something you're going to potentially find on exams with third generation cephalosporins like ceftriaxone, although that's usually more in the pediatric population. We can also find this again with just estrogen, with anabolic steroids, with OCPs, things like that. So if a woman is on hormone replacement therapy and you notice she starts getting like jaundice and she has direct hyperbilirubinemia, then you want to think about this person potentially having hepatic cholestasis. Remember, intrahepatic cholestasis is also something you can find in pregnancy, right? You'll be a pregnant woman. Because again, remember, in pregnancy, you have very high levels of estrogen, right? I literally just said that OCPs, estrogen, and all these anabolic steroids can cause cholestasis. Well, surprise, surprise, pregnancy is a high estrogen state. It would absolutely make sense that this people can get cholestasis. That's actually the pathophase behind the intrahepatic cholestasis of pregnancy. Remember, for those people, we're going to give them orsodiol. Remember, sometimes we call orsodiol orsodeoxycholic acid, right? So we can use that for that purpose on exams. And then, what if they give you a question about a patient? They tell you that this patient tried to commit suicide, right? And they tell you that the person has like a GI bleed. If you see something like that, I would really hope you're thinking of iron poisoning. Remember, iron loves to torch a person's stomach. It can cause like a hemorrhagic gastritis. So iron is obviously not the best idea. So if you ever see a person and, you know, it's a drug of abuse situation and you see them having like hemocol positive stools or a lot of like GI bleeding, I really, really want you to think about iron poisoning. Many times, if you actually take an x-ray, because remember, iron is like an actual metal. So when you take an x-ray, you're actually going to see the pills pretty clearly on radiography. So that's something you can keep in mind for exams. And then what if they give you a question about a patient and they tell you that this patient had a gonococcal had like a pelvic inflammatory disease. Let's call it PID, right? Had PID, person was placed on pharmacotherapy, but now this person has this rash on their skin that worsens with certain exposure. And of course, the MDME is they'll probably put some drug-induced lupus answer, which will be wrong. In this case, I want you to think about tetracyclines. Tetracyclines. These things are not good, right? They can cause photosensitivity. Remember, tetracyclines, you're told many times, they can even give you a question where a person is on tetracyclines and they say, oh, which of the following should be explained to the patient prior to discharge or whatever. You want to tell them to try to avoid the sun because it's associated with photosensitivity, right? So tetracyclines have a very strong association with photosensitivity. And there are other drugs that have that association. Sulfonamides, also associated with photosensitivity. Amiodarone is also associated with photosensitivity. In fact, there's this mnemonic that I learned back in the day in med school called SAT for photo. SAT for photo. The S stands for sulfonamides. The A stands for amiodarone. The T stands for tetracyclines. Those drugs are associated with photosensitivity as a side effect. Again, that's very high yield, very important to know for exams. And then what if they give you a question about a patient and they tell you that this patient person had an MI like 6 months ago and they're on pharmacotherapy because they had a stent placed in their hearts. And then they tell you that this person, when they get out of bed in the morning, they feel like the world is spinning around them. And they tell you that they have this buzzing sensation in their ears. If you see that, I would really hope you're saying, oh, Divine, this is salicylate poisoning, right? So, or salicylate toxicity. Remember, this is something we'll find with aspirin, right? Remember, it can cause tinnitus. It can cause vertigo, right? Salicylates. And remember, again, salicylates can also cause a person to have a combination metabolic acidosis and respiratory alkalosis. Although, remember, salicylates, I don't know, the MBMEs, they like this kind of question where they'll give you salicylate poisoning and they'll give you answers and they'll give you some sodium and potassium stuff. It's just kind of important to remember that salicylates don't really affect your sodium or potassium balance at all. The things they really mess up are your pH, your bicarb, and your PCO2. They lower your PCO2, because they cause a respiratory alkalosis. They lower your bicarb because they cause a metabolic acidosis, right? Acetylsalicylic acid is literally an acid. But your pH will be roughly normal for the most part because that metabolic acidosis kind of counters the respiratory alkalosis. That's something you certainly want to make sure you know for exams. And then what if they give you a question about a patient? They tell you that this patient came into the hospital, you know, for surgery and like a knee replacement or something, and then they tell you that the person 5 days after they have the surgery and just prior to discharge, some labs are obtained and you notice that their platelet count is like 40,000. What happened? Well, the thing that happened is HIT. Remember, HIT is heparin induced thrombocytopenia. So that's what happens whenever you get any heparin product like low molecular weight heparin or unfractionated heparin. Remember, those are both heparin products, but they're not the same. There's unfractionated heparin, that's like the straight up heparin, and then there's low molecular weight heparin that for the most part is a factor 10 inhibitor. The unfractionated heparin is more of a factor 10 and factor 2 inhibitor. So what's the pathophysiology behind HIT? Well, basically, heparin will make a complex with something called platelet factor 4. Platelet factor 4 is a platelet protein. When those two get married, it actually makes your platelets get activated. So you're going to be forming all these platelet thrombi and all these things, which obviously puts you in a hypercoagulable situation. But also, your platelet count goes down because you're using up those platelets. So those people, what's going to be your first step for them on exams? The very first thing you want to do for these people on exams is obviously go ahead and stop the heparin product. If you see that as an answer, that's always the better answer than treating. That's always the first thing you should do. And then after you do that, the next thing you want to do on exams is to put them on a factor 2 inhibitor. So something like Agatroban or Dabigatran or Bivalirudin. Remember, Bivalirudin, right, is a anticoagulant, right? It's a factor 2 inhibitor. It's derived from leeches, right? Or made on the same principle behind leeches. Because remember, leeches, they suck blood. If you want to suck a person's blood, you got to make sure that that blood is flowing. You don't want the blood to clot after it started sucking. I mean, there goes your lunch or dinner or breakfast if you're a leech. So the leeches, they actually inject an anticoagulant into the host, and then the so that the blood can keep flowing, right? So it would make sense that an anticoagulant would be derived from leeches, right? Remember, leeches, they belong to the class Hirudinea, right? That's where the term bivalirudin comes from, right? So bivalirudin, agatroban, dabigatran. So some people usually ask me, Divine, can we use a factor 10 inhibitor for HIT? So like apixaban, rivaroxaban, edoxaban. Yes, you can use those things. But like 99% of the time on MBME exams, they go more for the factor 2 inhibitors. So that's kind of high yield to know for exams. So heparin can cause thrombocytopenia. But remember, thrombocytopenia is also something you can find with quinidine. Quinidine, right? It can cause synchronism. Thrombocytopenia is something you can have, but synchronism also involves that ringing in the ear. So if you see ringing in the ear, tinnitus, you really want to think about two drugs and one disorder on exams. The two drugs, one is aspirin and your other salicylates. Two is quinidine. And then in terms of a disorder, you want to think about a person that has Meniere's disease. Remember, Meniere's disease, sometimes they call it on exams, endolymphatic high drops, is also associated with tinnitus or ringing in the ears. So it'll be a person that has this feeling of fullness in the ears. You see stuff like that, think about Meniere's disease. Okay, think about Meniere's disease. And then what if they give you a question about a patient that is pregnant, and then this patient was started on an antihypertensive, you know, because they had hypertension, and then they tell you that the person develops jaundice, but then you notice that this jaundice is associated with an indirect hyperbilirubinemia. If you see that, what should you be thinking about? I really hope you're saying, Divine, this sounds an awful lot like a hemolytic anemia, right? So notice the MDMEs, in their great wisdom, they're going to put like HELLP syndrome or something weird. They'll put like HELLP syndrome, or they'll put like intrahepatic cholestasis of pregnancy as answers, but those will be wrong. So remember, let's kind of tease this apart little by little, right? So first things first, intrahepatic cholestasis of pregnancy is going to give you an obstructive pattern of liver disease. So the direct bilirubin is going to be up. The outflux is going to be up. Okay. People that have HELLP syndrome, right? They'll have hemolytic anemia. They'll have low elevated liver enzymes, low platelets, fine. But that's more of an acute situation. And that's something you're going to be seeing in the third trimester on exams, right? But you see this person, they have this hemolytic anemia. They have indirect hyperbilirubinemia. That's important. And you see the temporal association with institution of an antihypertensive in pregnancy. You want to be thinking about hemolytic anemias. Remember, hemolytic anemias are very common with methyl-DOPA. they're very common with methyl-DOPA. Methyl-DOPA is something we can use to manage hypertension in pregnancy. Remember, hypertension in pregnancy, we can also manage it with hydralazine, labetalol, or nifedipine, right? But methyl-DOPA is associated with hemolytic anemias. And don't forget, you can also get hemolytic anemias with the cell wall inhibitors like penicillin. So they can give you a question about a woman that develops indirect hyperbilirubinemia after getting treatment for like Grubi strep or something like that. You want to think about hemolytic anemias. Quinidine also, again, quinidine is a pretty high value drug for exams, right? Again, it can cause hemolytic anemias, it can cause low platelets, and it can cause tinnitus, right? These are all high yield things you want to keep at the back of your mind for exams. And then remember, they can also give you questions about drugs on exams where, you know, people start these drugs, or let's say a person recently went for a procedure, got a local anesthetic, and then they start having perioral cyanosis. Well, that's going to be methemoglobinemia, right? Remember, methemoglobinemia is something you're going to find with drugs that are powerful oxidizing agents. So like local anesthetics, like benzocaine, all those drugs that end in cane. You can get them with like nitrate medications. You can get them with sulfonamides. You can get them with many different things. Nitrofurantoin, look at the name nitro, right? Nitrates, very powerful oxidizing agents. You can get them with like nitrofurantoin. You can get them with many things on exams, right? So don't forget, they can even give you a HIV patient started on Bactrim, trimethoprim sulfur methoxazole. Those things are very powerful oxidizing agents, right? And you're going to have a much higher risk if you have like G6PD deficiency, because you're not going to be able to deal with oxidative stress at all. So don't forget methemoglobinemia. Obviously, in those circumstances, you're going to treat with methylene blue. And then they can give you a question about a person that is on a chemotherapeutic agent. And then a few days after therapy started, they start having like lower extremity edema, jugular venous distension, new S3 heart sound. When you see that, right, you want to think about a cardiomyopathy. More specifically, you want to think about a dilated cardiomyopathy, right? So remember, that's something we're going to find with doxo and donorubicin. Those are the anthracyclines. They cause an irreversible dilated cardiomyopathy that could have been prevented if you took like dextrosoxin, which is an iron chelator. Because remember, the Fenton reaction is essentially how these doxo donorubicin agents can cause problems. And then they can also give you a breast cancer patient on that has the HER2 mutation, right? And obviously, in those circumstances, trastuzumab. In fact, they call it Herceptin. There's this mnemonic I think I may have seen in first aid back in the day, like Heartceptin, how these drugs can also cause a dilated cardiomyopathy. Remember, trastuzumab can cause a reversible dilated cardiomyopathy, but doxo and donorubicin can cause an irreversible dilated cardiomyopathy. Again, very high yield to keep this stuff at the back of your mind for exams. And then do not forget, any drug that inhibits folate synthesis can cause megaloblastic anemia on exams, right? So if a person is on methotrexate, it can, remember, that inhibits dihydrofolate reductase, that can absolutely cause megaloblastic anemia. But also, if you're on sulfonamides, right, trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole, that can cause a megaloblastic anemia in a HIV patient. If you're on OCPs, if you're on 5-FU, right, 5-fluorouracil, remember, 5-fluorouracil inhibits thymidylate synthase, it can absolutely cause megaloblastic anemia. Or if you're on 5-fluocytosine as a HIV patient for a long enough period of time, yes, it can absolutely also cause megaloblastic anemia. Because remember, 5-fluocytosine is converted by cytosine deaminase to 5-fluorouracil, right? And that will then go ahead and inhibit thymidylate synthase in the fungus, more specifically Cryptococcus neoformans. That's why we would use, that's the only reason we would use 5-fluocytosine, right? So all those things can cause macrocytic anemias, the sulfonamides, trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole, right? Phenytoin. Many of these anti-epileptic drugs, they can cause, they can inhibit folate synthesis. That's why you try to avoid giving those drugs to pregnant women, right? Because of this whole concern about neurotube defects. So again, these are all things you want to keep at the back of your mind for exams. And then don't forget, you know, if they give you a person that was studying on an antihypertensive and they have cough, you really, really want to be thinking about your ACE inhibitors, right? Because remember, they inhibit ACE, and ACE is an enzyme that breaks down bradykinin. But if you're inhibiting ACE, then you're not going to be able to break down bradykinin. So bradykinin levels are going to go up, and you're going to get in trouble, right? So those are just all things you want to keep at the back of your mind on exams. And then don't forget, you see a person, they take antibiotics, and then they have like a watery or bloody diarrhea afterwards. That's C. diff, right? C. diff diarrhea is something you can absolutely get after taking antibiotics. You see, recent antibiotic use, diarrhea afterwards, watery, bloody, doesn't matter. That's going to be C. diff. Obviously, for C. diff, you're going to use oral vancomycin or fidaxomicin as treatment. And then, also do not forget that NSAIDs, regular NSAIDs, you want to avoid them right after an MI. You want to avoid them right after an MI. At least for the first 6 months after an MI, the only NSAID you really should be taking is aspirin, right? That's something you want to keep at the back of your mind for exams. And then don't forget, many of these antiplatelet drugs, many of these anticoagulants, they cause bleeding. Bleeding is like a very big thing that's associated with many of these drugs, right? So don't forget bleeding. So the key thing I just really wanted to hit here, I guess maybe let me say a few more things. Again, I don't want this podcast to go for too long. But don't forget, if you see peripheral neuropathy, there are certain drugs that cause peripheral neuropathy. They can give you a TB patient. Those are going to be, that's going to be isoniazid. It can absolutely cause a peripheral neuropathy. But don't forget the anti-cancer drugs, vincristine and vinblastine, right? Vincristine and vinblastine, those things are absolutely associated with peripheral neuropathy. Vincristine, vinblastine, those have a very strong association with peripheral neuropathy. Those are the key ones you want to know. Hemorrhagic cystitis, right? Remember, you can get hemorrhagic cystitis from adenovirus. Adenovirus is something that can absolutely cause hemorrhagic cystitis. But besides adenovirus, you can also get this with cyclophosphamide. So they can give you a question about a person that is on pharmacotherapy for one of these vasculitides, right? Like Churg-Strauss, which we call eosinophilic granulomatosis with polyangiitis, or Wegener's, which we call granulomatosis with polyangiitis. Remember, those things can absolutely positively cause hemorrhagic cystitis, right? Cyclophosphamide, the treatment for those disorders, can absolutely cause hemorrhagic cystitis. And then if you see a person that just has a lot of emesis, like a lot of vomiting, and you're on a chemotherapeutic agent, think of your platinum agents. Your platinum agents are very big on causing a lot of they are very good, big on causing a lot of vomiting. In fact, it was understanding the pharmacology of chemotherapeutic of those platinum agents like cisplatin that ondansetron was formed, because they realized that this cisplatin has very powerful serotonin receptor agonist activity, and that's how it causes this emesis in the by stimulating the chemoreceptor trigger zone. So drug companies kind of figured out, you know what, if we shut down these serotonin receptors with Zofran, you know, that's the trade name, it's on ondansetron, then in those circumstances, you can stop that chemotherapy-induced emesis. So that's just something you want to keep at the back of your mind for exams. So I'm going to go ahead and stop here. I believe I've covered, again, there are many drug adverse reactions, but that more extended discussion is probably more so for step one than for step two, CK step three. But if you listen to this, I suspect that the vast majority of the adverse drug reactions questions, you'll get them right for step two, for step three, for complex level two, complex level three. So thank you for listening to me. Again, I do offer one-on-one tutoring for all the USMLE exams, step one to step three, complex level one to three. The only thing I don't tutor is OMM and all those legal things that show up with complex. But I tutor to pretty much every other part of these exams. And I mean, if you want one-on-one tutoring for me, this is something you have to book far into the future, because my schedule fills up pretty quickly. And then I also offer these group courses for step two CK and step three. I already discussed them at the very beginning of this podcast. And then I also have these podcasts on Apple Podcasts, on Google Podcasts, on Spotify, at least the most recent 150. And then I have a YouTube channel, Divine Intervention USMLE Podcasts and Videos. That's where I post the videos that I make. And then if you want to get an email notification whenever I make a podcast, or if you want to see all my podcasts from episode one, and remember, they're all free, you know, not charging for them, from episode one all the way to episode 387, which is this episode, I believe, right? Go ahead and on the website, divineinterventionpodcasts.com. And then I also have a new website called divineinterventionlifelessons.com, where I post some life lessons. Many of you know I'm a Christian, so I make podcasts relating to some Bible-based lessons, you know, that address just common problems that are faced by humanity. I even have it on Apple Podcasts. It's called the Divine Intervention Life Lessons Podcast. So thank you for listening to me today. The one encouragement I will encourage you, I guess the one life lesson I'll put today, is just the importance of being wise with your priorities. The thing is, many people, they spend, you know, I'm sure many of you have heard of this 80-20 rule. You see, many people, they spend like 20% of their lives on things that should be their number one priorities, and 80% of their lives on things that should absolutely not be a priority for them. So I would just encourage you to live a more high-yield life. How do you live a more high-yield life? You live a more high-yield life by just spending most of your hours on things that have value for your life, on things that should be your number one priorities. So for example, if you have a family and you're spending 10 hours a day watching on social media, I don't want to mention any specific companies here, on social media or on a streaming service, you have your priorities all wrong. That is just the truth. You know, maybe once in a while, it's your day off, fine, whatever. But, you know, if you have a family and you're not spending adequate amounts of time with them, I'm telling you, like, when you work in an ICU and you see people passing away, trust me, the only people they want around them are their families. They don't want their gadgets or social media or their favorite streaming service around them. You know, they want to spend time with their families. So don't wait till the end, you know. Spend time on those things that matter right now. Again, I'm not saying social media doesn't matter. I'm not saying watching streaming services doesn't matter. Those things absolutely matter. They are very good for keeping a person in check mentally. But I will also encourage you to just prioritize your life. Prioritize your life. If you're a medical student listening to this, you know that the process is getting more and more competitive every year. Then what are you doing spending 12 hours every day playing video games and stuff, right? You got to order your priorities right. Because again, you can pay now and play later, or you can play now and pay later, right? So if you do the wrong thing now, then you're going to be needing people to make calls for you to match into residencies. And you're going to have to be worrying about, oh, wow, I have to do even better. I need to do all these things. I need to take this year off or whatever to make my application better. Again, nothing wrong with taking a year off. There are certain disciplines where it's pretty much a requirement, right? But you see some people, I've definitely worked with some people where they're literally taking a year off because they just don't have competitive scores. And that year off, you may be like, wow, it's not that big of a deal. It's just an extra year. But just imagine you're losing a year of a physician's salary, and then those bad decisions you took begin to take on more and more importance. So just kind of think about all these things when you're making decisions. Just put your priorities right. Put your priorities right. Have the right priorities. Even how you in how you purchase things. You see some people, they purchase stuff that they don't need. They purchase stuff that for their level of income just makes absolutely no sense. So I'll just encourage you, just be wise with how you use your resources. Be wise with how you use your time, because time is one of those things that once it's gone, you'll never get it back. In fact, there's this part of the Bible that says, teach us to number our days so we can apply our hearts to wisdom. Basically, what the Bible is saying, be wise with how you use your time. Be wise with your priorities. So I'll encourage you, just be prudent. Put your priorities right in life so you can create a very bright, very vibrant future for yourself. Until next time, have a wonderful rest of your day. God bless you. Thank you.